Welcome to another evening in the Michigan Writers Series. Tonight we present Sue William Silverman, short story writer, memoirist, creative writing teacher, professional speaker on incest and child sexual abuse, and associate editor of Fourth Genre, Explorations in Nonfiction, published by the Michigan State University Press. She is the author of the stunning and very well-received book on creative nonfiction, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, just released in paperback by the University of Georgia Press. She has had two short stories nominated for the Pushcart Prize and is a frequent judge for fiction and nonfiction writing awards. She conducts creative writing and creative nonfiction workshops at various colleges, universities, and writers' conferences around the country in conjunction with readings and speeches. Please welcome Sue William Silverman.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Michigan Writers Series for inviting me here tonight. Since this forum is, in fact, the Michigan Writers Series, I'd like to begin tonight, before I read from my memoir, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, by reading just the short beginning of an essay I wrote that explains a bit about the process I use when I write, and it's a process really that helped me write this book. The name of the essay is Etude in Blue. And then I'll also return to the essay at the end of my reading before we have a question and answer period. And this is actually the first time I've read aloud from this essay. In fact, it's not even quite finished yet, but we'll see how it goes. Etude in Blue. One night, unable to sleep, I watched an autumn moon framed in my bedroom window in Michigan. It paused, large and luminous, as if hovering just the other side of the glass. I was startled. I hadn't observed the moon for a long time, hadn't followed its journey across its night home in the sky. Now, seemingly so close, so intimate, I almost believed if I breathed deeply, I'd be able to smell it. I sensed it, cool, blue, heavy, anchoring the sky, anchoring me with blue dreams of the universe. But the moon is not blue. What color, objectively, is it, I wondered. Dark white? Gray white? I tried to remember facts about the moon. What information, discovered by NASA and the astronauts, had I read in newspapers and magazines? What pictures had I seen beamed from the Hubble spacecraft? I thought about getting out of bed and switching on my computer, logging on to Moon to see what data could be retrieved, not from my personal observed space, but from cyberspace. I didn't get out of bed. I realized I didn't want to propel myself into the science of this new century. Shouldn't I rely on the observation of my own senses instead? After all, why log on to scientific evidence of moon when I had this? Most of the moon shone in one pane of glass, the remainder in another. In this split image, a glimmer of reflected light leaked behind the orb, causing a fuzzy boundary, blurring perception, so that I observed one large moon trailed by a smaller one. This slur of moon, a mock, yet more enchanting than the moon itself, for it was a personal moon that only I could see in the glass of my window. I wanted to feel the moon, touch it, taste it. I imagined it a chunk of blue cheese, a sweet shard of rock candy, cool as blue ice. I wondered why, when I saw or imagined the moon, my synesthetic heart felt the word blue. I allowed my mind to unfocus, to drift, to journey wherever sensory association lured me, flowing from image to image, from moon to heart, to lonely heart, to empty nights, to blue moon, to specific moments when the moon and my heart blued. In this late-night semi-dream state, it was as if I tumbled out my bedroom window here in Michigan, a window of time to be imaginatively cast into other places, other times. I tumbled backward to childhood, to adolescence, to other nights. I felt a yearning for other moons. I luxuriated in billowing strands of connotative memory as I traveled from this moon in Michigan to nights that still lingered in shadows of my mind. To Caribbean nights, when, as an island girl, I watched the moon darken with arcing branches of royal poinciana and frangipani trees. The Caribbean moon blued with reflected water from the Viridian and turquoise sea. Lying in bed in a froth of mosquito netting in a room with open shutters, I watched the cool eye of the moon watch me through long blue tropical nights. Once bidden, once encouraged, once invited, how swiftly senses retrieve the past. Now I see a teenage self still linger in the memory of my senses. Yes, all these years later, still I long for sad teenage songs and mentally dance across a high school gym in New Jersey to strains of Blue Moon with Jamie, my boyfriend. Even as I glance at this Michigan moon, I feel feet slow to Blue Moon. I saw you standing alone. I smell Jamie's scent of ivory soap, see the blonde hair on the backs of his wrists. Still, I remember how blue I felt when he left me. From the West Indies to New Jersey, now I am tugged by sensual tides of association to Israel. I was living on a kibbutz during the first moonwalk, while Israeli friends gathered around a television set for glimpses of Neil Armstrong and his spaceship. I wandered into the dark hush of fields and lay on the ground beside mishmish trees. I watched the real moon, not a speck of spaceship visible, not even wanting to see it invade the moon's cool peace. I watched the moon with the scent of warm apricots in the ancient night. I miss my friends in the States. I missed the familiarity of language and location. I missed a boyfriend from whom I'd recently parted. I felt alone. I felt blue. Now, lying in my bedroom in Michigan, I realized that for years I'd missed poinciana trees, the song Blue Moon, the scent of apricots at night. I missed the moon. More, that over the years I had been losing my senses, losing my personal perception of moons, suns, stars, winds, climates, flowers, trees, seas. And worse, once I lose my senses, I lose my surest connection to memory. In this high-tech age, we all risk losing the art of daydream, of gazing out windows, lose the very art of lingering over tastes and sounds and scents. We are losing the mystery of quirky individual perception, losing the ability to create our own moons to dream by, even if that moon is a mock. For we receive our information from the same computerized source, and the source is cold and plastic and metal. And as I mentally tumbled through my bedroom window through time, I realized not only had I been losing my senses, just as important, I was losing the creative language that flows from them, the ability to form association and metaphor that connects me to sensual mysteries of the past. At times, I teach creative writing courses to students, some of who hate English and hate to write. At least they claim to hate it, claim they have nothing to say, nothing worth saying. In a way, this is both true and not. They do have stories. They don't know it because they don't remember their senses. I urge them on archaeological digs, probing memory that dwells deep in sensory experience. Take off your shoes, I tell them. Metaphorically, walk through your childhoods. What do you feel? Fresh mowed grass under the soles of your feet? Sand? Hot pavement? Frigid streets? Open the window of your childhood bedroom. What do you see? What do you smell? Lilacs, exhaust fumes, oceans, icicles, snow. Follow this trail of senses. Where does it lead you? Where do you go? What do you taste? What does your heart remember? Follow a whisper of sense, of sounds, of touch, I tell my students. Journey back in time, for the past, all of what came before, facts, fantasies, daydreams, imagination, must be remembered in order to be an authentic adult, an authentic you that's different from an authentic me, a you with something worth writing about. I must remove my own shoes, open my own windows, reclaim my own senses. I must retrieve senses understood in childhood, too easily lost in the rush and pound of being an adult. I must never lose sight of the moon. So now, even as I gaze at this particular Michigan moon, I must know I'm not only here, I'm also there and there, back there. From 1933 to 1953, my father was chief counsel to the Secretary of the Interior. He was architect of the preliminary papers establishing statehood for Alaska and Hawaii. He assisted in the plans for Philippine independence, helped create the Puerto Rican Commonwealth, and worked to implement home rule for the Virgin Islands, Guam, and Samoa. I have photographs of my father with President Harry Truman, Adlai Stevenson, Governor Richard Hughes of New Jersey, Senator Henry Scoop Jackson. My father was also a child molester. I know, because he sexually molested me. When officials from the Trust Territories are in town, they dine with us at the house. My father and I greet our company at the door while my mother cooks in the kitchen. I wear frilly dresses with white socks and patent leather shoes. I offer hors d'oeuvres arranged on monkey pod platters and carry drinks in white linen cocktail napkins. I smile. I sing songs. I love to show off my dolls. I am a beloved pet performing, showing what a happy child I am. What a happy family we are. After everyone leaves, the house again is quiet. No, it is more than quiet. Where is my sister? I never know. I stand in the living room in my pretty dress, staring out the picture window into the nighttime yard. But I see no yard. In the glass, the living room is reflected, so there is no outside world at all. No yard. No trees, nothing beyond that window. And I, all of us, are trapped inside the glass, for even if my sister fled the house, her flight, her need for flight, is the trap itself. And inside the house, if I scream, no one will hear. If I could scream, I know that glass would shatter. But my father is the only one with a voice, the only one who knows how to scream. If something went wrong during the party, if the food were not perfect, if some detail were overlooked, then, after everyone leaves, his rage is swift and solid. But the glass on the window will never shatter, for his wrath is turned on us, his three little girls. It is our brittle bones that will absorb the shock of his voice. We are the only ones who will ever hear him, for everyone outside the house believes my father is perfect. In the midst of his anger, my mother will cry. I will cry. My sister will be dry and vacant. I wait to be hit. If I am, then later, while my mother washes dishes, my father and I go down the hall to the bathroom, to the bathtub, where he loves to soothe me. Perhaps I am almost asleep by the time he undresses me and slips me into the water. His voice whispers that he adores me, that all he wants is to make me happy. Susie, my most precious daughter, you are more precious to me than life, he tells me, while his finger, ever so gently, enters my drowsy body. After we leave Washington, D.C., we move to the West Indies. All year I wait for Carnival, when the island itself seems decorated with masks and feathers and flowers. The park is crisscrossed with colored lights, while Carnival booths are adorned with crepe and palm fronds. I watch the dancers, hear the rush and rustle of Madras skirts, the pong of steel drum bands. I pass booths selling coconut balls, orange wine, sugar cake. I buy a guava ice and stand under a lignum vitae tree, watching the moko jumbies, invisible spirits who walk on stilts. They wear mirrored costumes so no one can see them. When you look at them, you see yourself. I imagine my own body camouflaged with tiny glass mirrors. After I finished the ice, I crossed the park to a beautiful booth draped in silver scarves and lights. An old woman, her hair wrapped in a head tie, leans against the counter next to a hurricane lantern. The sign tacked to the booth reads, "Cup of snakeweed tea, 25 cents. Glass of Clarin, 75. I place four quarters on the counter. "Can I have some?" I ask. "I've never heard of the drinks, but I like the sound of the names." She takes only one quarter, telling me I'm too young for Clarin, but she'll give me a cup of tea. From a pitcher, she pours a dark liquid into a tiny china cup. Drinking it, I seem to taste tree roots after a tropical storm. At first, the taste is mild, but at the bottom of the cup is a thick, rich residue. And I wonder if this is a black magic potion. I think it must be, and I wonder if I will now have secret powers. Returning the cup to her, I smile, thanking her. "You like it?" she says. "Yes," I say. She nods and tells me I have a pretty smile. My fingers rush to my lips as if to feel this smile. This concrete information seems overwhelmingly important. A pretty smile on my own face. Now, I don't so much want to be a Moko Jumbi as I want to be able to look at one, at his mirrors, in order to see this smile, one I myself never noticed. Slowly I move past thinning crowds. This last night of carnival, booths are being dismantled, decorations folded for next year. And I realize I don't want carnival to end. I want to live here in this carnival with Moko Jumbis and with steel drum bands. I want to live with the woman and her snake weed tea. If she feeds me weed tea every morning, I will smile. But carnival is over. I fear I'll never see this woman again. She has given me a special tea that has given me a special secret power, my special smile. Is she the only one who can see my true, true smile? Why does my father see something, someone different? I have a special smile that my own daddy can't see, even when he is very close to me. From the West Indies, we moved to Glenrock, New Jersey. In 10th grade, Elizabeth invites me to her pajama party. I take this literally, that I must bring pajamas. But my mother won't give me money to buy any. She says what I sleep in, that nightgown, is what I will bring. She will not waste money on. On what? Suddenly I'm not sure about any of my clothes. Once I wore a tight-knit sweater to school, and I thought I noticed a surprised hesitation to my boyfriend Christopher's hello. At the time I thought little of it, but now I'm unsure. My mother helped me select the ruby-red dress I wore to the Paradise of Hearts dance. The cut was lower than the cut on other girls' dresses. But my mother says it's okay to look this way. It's important to attract boys. Just don't allow them to touch you. So when I receive the invitation to the pajama party, I'm scared all my clothes are wrong. For school, for dances, for pajama parties. Wrong for Christopher. I take the bus to Ridgewood and wander the aisles at Seal Funds, where my friends shop, usually not where my mother and I buy clothes. Oxford shirts with button-down collars, plaid sweater and skirt sets, loose-fitting with matching knee socks. Well, yes, I have clothes like these too, but Seal Funds sells no ruby-red dresses or tight-knit sweaters. The clothes here are teenage clothes, while my mother takes me to stores for adults. And I know I cannot bring a nightgown to Elizabeth's party. I wander to the sleepwear section and study exotic flannel pajamas. I take a blue pair with white flowers into the dressing room, slip off my skirt and sweater, and try them on. Perfect. They fit loosely, showing no contours of my body. I smooth my hands over the fabric. I believe if I owned these, I would be able to curl inside them and sleep undisturbed for years, smelling and feeling their warm comfort. I have no money, but I must own these pajamas. I must steal them. I must. I cannot leave without them. I roll the cuffs to my knees, put my skirt on, pull my sweater over the top, and zip up my jacket. Slowly, I leave the store. Since I want the pajamas to remain new and clean and pretty, the way I know the other girls' pajamas will be, I wait for the night of the party to wear them. Once I shed my school clothes, button the top of the pajamas, and slip my legs into the bottoms, I safely blend into the group of girls. Camouflaged in my flannel uniform, I smile, pleased I made the right choice, all by myself, on what to wear for the party. Our sleeping bags, blankets, and pillows are spread across the carpeted living room floor. We roll each other's hair in plastic rollers. We paint each other's fingernails with pink and white pearly polish. We play rock and roll records and dance. At midnight, Elizabeth's mother brings us boxes of donuts. We gossip about boys and tell secrets. "You think Christopher will ask you to go steady?" Robin says. "I don't know," I say. "Maybe. I hope so." "My mom says I'm too young to get involved," Elizabeth says. Quickly, I glance down at my pink nails, worried I might have given the wrong answer. "Oh, of course," I say. "My mom tells me the same thing." "It's not like you got to do everything your mother tells you," Robin says. "She tells us her mom allows her to kiss her boyfriend only if she keeps her feet on the floor. Except she demonstrates how it is possible to lie on a couch and still keep at least one foot on the floor." We all practice. I am slow to learn this. I am, I must be, the most innocent of all. Late at night, I go to the bathroom. The door is closed, so I wait, admiring my new pajamas. I press the crook of my arm to my face, breathing the material. It smells good and new. And suddenly, I am afraid to sleep in them, afraid when I wake in the morning, they will no longer smell clean or good or new. Perhaps I should slip them off while everyone is sleeping and change into my clothes. The door opens, and I pull back, surprised. I'd assumed one of the girls was inside, but it's Elizabeth's father in his robe. He holds the door open, but I can't move. I don't understand. I'm confused by his sudden presence in this nighttime hall. He smiles and jokes. I barely hear him. Something about girls and noise and fun. I mean, what he says is nice. His smile is nice. That's all it is, but I can't respond. I fear my new pajamas will be criticized. He will tell me to change them. No, he will unbutton them. He will. But he doesn't do any of this. He walks down the hall to a bedroom. He opens a door. As he does, I hear a woman, his wife, say something to him. From the tone, what she says doesn't seem to be significant. Probably, "Please turn off the light." She is not angry. Nor is she silent. The door closes. For a moment, there is a rim of light beneath the door, but then it disappears. The room he shares with his wife is dark. Still, I can't move. I lean against the wall and close my eyes. I think I am waiting for something. I wait for that door to open again. He will return, come back down the hall, silently. No one will hear, except everyone hears, but he does it anyway because he can't stop. But that door, the door behind which Elizabeth's father sleeps with his wife, does not open. He does not walk back down the hall. How do I know he sleeps in that room all night? How do I know he doesn't leave it? Maybe from the definite way the door tapped shut. Maybe from the sound of his wife's voice. Maybe from the still air here in the hall, air that will not be disturbed again until morning. Or maybe because I believe Elizabeth's mother knows how to teach her daughter, knows how to guide her. For the briefest of moments, more a sense than one clear thought, I understand that what I do every night is not repeated in every other girl's bedroom, down every street and block, in every neighborhood, all across town. Had I believed that what I do with my father is usual? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. But then, as definitively as Elizabeth's father shut the door to the bedroom he shares with his wife, that thought, the thought that I might be alone, that what I do is not repeated, is not normal, is slammed from my mind. All night I'm awake. I'm afraid someone will see me if I change into my clothes, so I lie awake in my pajamas, not moving, not wanting to wrinkle them. I spread my arms to the side so I won't sweat on the clean material. I think I know my love for these pajamas is irrational. At least I know the other girls don't seem concerned about theirs. But I want these pajamas to last the rest of my life. They have to, but I'm scared they will be taken from me. They will be ripped. That place between my legs feels safe behind the tightly sewn seam. But I have this small dread the seam might split, so I don't move my legs. I lie perfectly still until morning. On Monday, I neatly refold the pajamas along the creases and return them to the store, leaving them in a paper bag in the dressing room. I must. I would not be able to bear seeing the pajamas wrinkled. I was in college when I saw the word incest for the first time, almost by chance, in conjunction with the movie Phaedra. When I saw the word, my gaze hesitated. It stopped, couldn't flow along the line of words preceding and succeeding it. My breath stopped, my heart stopped, my throat was cold and my mouth rigid. But why? Since I'd never seen the word before, never read the word before, never heard the word uttered. I didn't know what the word meant, yet it stopped me like a slap. I looked it up in the dictionary. At first I read and reread the definition, but I didn't allow myself to understand any of the words used to explain it. I didn't know what I was reading. I had to look up each word in the definition and write each word on a sheet of paper. The statutory crime committed by such closely related persons who marry, cohabit, or copulate illegally. Copulate, to engage in coitus, to fasten together, link. My father and I are fastened together. We are linked. I feel a revulsion I don't understand when I see the word copulate. The three short, hard syllables slam against my teeth as I whisper the word over and over. I feel a fear I think I understand too well when I see the words illegal, crime, forbidden. A crime has been committed. I know I'm responsible. I've committed unpardonable sins. But I don't understand what the sins are. I have these words written on a piece of paper. I will be punished for these words, but I don't know why. I see the movie. I watch a mother and a son in bed together. That night, all night, I feel my father in bed with me, yet he is not with me. My body only feels as if he is. I feel as if he's exploding through my body, my throat, and into the roof of my mouth. But days later, I can pretend the word and the movie don't exist, or dictionaries and movies lie. With equal ability, I can also pretend the word and the movie have nothing to do with me, nothing to do with what happened to me with my father. This movie, this word, more, my childhood, my memories are like the ocean, like tides in the sea. Memories roll close to me, curled in the scroll of a wave, suddenly revealed when the wave crashes ashore. Then the memory ebbs, flowing out to sea. Memories tugged back and forth by the moon, memories of what happened at night with my father. But never does the ocean evaporate. So never can I forget. What I most lack is understanding. I don't understand what happened to me because I don't understand the darkness of the deep, mysterious sea. I don't understand this darkness, this mystery, because I know no words to decipher it. To ensure I never do, there are moments of time when I don't allow myself to see words, when I can't see any word, for any word might reveal a truth I don't want to know. So for days after seeing the movie, I'm unable to read even one word with ease. None. I can't read magazines. I can't look at billboards or street signs. I can't glance at the mail. I can't look up a number in the phone book. But then there is no one to call. As long as I am wordless, I will not know the truth of the sin I have committed. When I'm an adult, I enter the hospital for treatment. Sunday, visiting day, I sit in the lounge and watch a woman named Macon. This morning I had sat next to her at breakfast, where she showed me a round gash in her tongue resembling a cigarette burn. In fact, she convulsed on a drug overdose while trying to commit suicide, and a tooth had sliced her tongue. Now, she silently stares at her hands folded in her lap, saying nothing to her family, glancing down. Her husband looks angry, his face thick with rage. Sweat spikes the dark hair on the nape of his neck, and the hair looks as if it is bristling. I can't hear his words, but his gestures strike the air as he speaks. Their daughter, she must be in the third or fourth grade, sits on the floor with crayons and coloring book, her head bowed. Her hair is yanked into a messy off-center ponytail, with clumps of hair spilling loose over her shoulders. Macon remains silent, studying her hands. Then I see it. My only surprise is that I didn't notice immediately. The daughter, not just her hair is unkempt. The daughter also wears her dress inside out. I know that either her father dressed her wrong in a hurry because he had undressed her in a hurry, or else she does this deliberately, wears her dress this way to send a message, a signal telling her mother, in this most accurate language, she is having an emergency. But Macon refuses to see. Macon doesn't see what she sees, even took pills to ensure she would never notice. She was willing to kill herself rather than know what she knows. But by sacrificing herself, she most truly was willing to sacrifice her daughter. But what had I really seen when I looked at Macon's daughter? I see a girl who is small, a girl who could never have seduced her father. I see her. I also see another little girl, one who, in her own accurately mute language, showed her underpants at school, stopped going to school, broke her collarbone at day camp when she too wanted someone to see. She was having an emergency. Father, I want to ask you, what do you remember? I want to ask you, what do you know? How did you first decide to open the door to enter my bedroom? What was your internal passage through time and space that brought you to my body, brought you to my bed? I want to ask if you remember what we did behind all the bedroom walls, where no one could see, when no one was watching. No one saw the curtains barely shutter as you opened the door, softly, so no one could hear. Or was no one listening? Because no one would want to hear this, ever. Except I heard, to me, your footsteps echoed as if you walked deserted corridors, always coming toward me. The air around you was fierce and tense. It was as thick as heat and unbreathable, combustible, urgent. Because I heard, I remember. And because I remember terror, Father, I remember you. Father, what do you remember? What I remember is that we never spoke, that I never uttered a sigh. I, your silent accomplice to unforgivable crimes, your secret partner in unspeakable sins. Did you love me, hate me, or think you merely owned me, my body, your possession? What did my skin say to you? Did my skin shudder like the curtains, or was it still? Shocked to silence. You are the core of a red sun. I stand encased in a sheet of burning glass until the sun shatters it. In silence, the pieces fall. You shattered me. You made me fall. It happened at night. Secrets happen at night. I waited for you to come at night. You still come at night, except now you come in dreams of blood. I'm asking you, Father, what do you remember? If you say nothing, I will tell you. If you say nothing, I will remind you that you, Father, were the one to hurt someone who was faint, who was diminished, who was small, your night daughter. And now I'm going to end with the last page of the essay that I started with. The moon has faded now for the night, drifted past the last frame of my window here in Michigan. No, it is not faded, for that is the power of imagination, connotation, the luxury of senses that produce memory. So when I see my moon, I feel moon-drenched Caribbean nights. When I see my moon, I hear the song Blue Moon, feel a shy touch of a high school boyfriend, and a heart brimming with nostalgia. When I see my moon, I smell apricots in a field in Israel. And even though I'm in my own bed tonight, am able to know a heart distant with longing to return home. And it does. My heart is now in my own personal home. For I live in worlds within worlds, words within words, my senses the unbreakable center of concentric circles of imagination and memory and time. Now, future moons will always remind me of this autumn moon, will remind me of this night here in Michigan, of the moon I saw reflected in my window. The moon I see will always be blue, and the heart that sees it must always yearn for a universe of blue possibilities. Thank you.